I'm Wes Moss.
The prevailing thought in America is that you'll never have enough money, and it's almost impossible to retire early. Actually, I think the opposite is true. For more than 20 years, I've been researching, studying, and advising American families, including those who started late, on how to retire sooner and happier. So my mission with the Retire Sooner podcast is to help a million people retire earlier while enjoying the adventure along the way. I'd love for you to be one of them. Let's get started. There are a lot of good books out there about money. Thousands of them. I'd like to think what the happiest retirees know is one of them. But of course, here on the Retire Sooner podcast, we like to cover books that we think are impactful and can be helpful to your Retire Sooner journey. I wish I'd actually read this book sooner, but I've heard so much hype around it. And one of my favorite quotes of the year is from this book, or at least from the author. And I thought it was high time I dug into The Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel. And on today's episode, I wanted to give you the highlights of that. Now, if you do this on audiobook, I think you can get through it in 7 or maybe 8 hours. But this is one of those books I liked so much that I couldn't stop taking notes on my iPhone. So I took 14 pages of notes when it came to this book, the stories, the lessons, and they all hit such a strong chord with me. And I thought, this is exactly what our Retire Sooner folks need to hear. So today is really my take on what I would say is a timeless and really well thought out book on money lessons from Morgan Housel. As an author, he's got tons of accolades. He's sold close to 5 million books, and he's been named one of the most influential people when it comes to markets and investing. But that's not why I wanted to cover the lessons. I'm covering it because he's perhaps the best person or writer to approach and give credit to the psychological side of money and investing. Yes, there's a lot of books around behavioral finance or BFI. We've talked a little bit about here on Retire Sooner. And nearly all of those books help identify the human money missteps that we take and kind of in a scoldy way tries to fix you as a broken human investor. But I haven't really found a lesson in behavioral finance or psychology around money that's this helpful and this actionable. And I really think Housel helps us with this. I think it gives the appropriate credit to not just our brain and our money, but the human psychology that pushes and pulls us in our different money directions. And by identifying our human nature and how we think about money, and how it really impacts our financial journey long-term with stories of people that exemplify these lessons, I think it's tremendously helpful. Now, there are 20 lessons in the book. I thought 20 was a little much. I tried to whittle it down to 10 because it's a nice round number, but I think I'm going to go over and we'll focus in on what I thought were the 14 most important, actionable that we can learn from and can help your Retire Sooner journey. With that, producer Mallory comes to the studio table.
Hello.
Mallory, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I'm so excited to be here.
I feel like it's been a little while since you've been on the show.
It has been. You know, we took a little bit of a breather. I was back in here in January when we were talking about Dave Ramsey, but I'm married.
You went on vacation or honeymoon. You know, you've been a busy lady.
All I'm saying is life is good. Life is good. So Wes, I love the fact that you actually picked up The Psychology of Money and were reading this book. And I loved when we were talking about it last week on Money Matters and you mentioned how you really wish that you could just get a good summary of it for an hour. And so then you essentially decided to do that for our listeners.
That was before.
Yes, before we had recorded. I guess it was right before we recorded.
Yeah, I know that I've seen book summaries online and I think it's Blinkist or there's a couple places and I've tried them out and it hasn't been exactly what I was thinking, but I'm kind of doing exactly what I would like someone to have done when it comes to this book. However, this one is so important. I wanted to get every single nook and cranny out of it, but I think because I did dive into it and spent so many hours parsing it and try to whittle down to the most important pieces, that's what we're trying to do here today. So sure. Yes. Please go out and buy the book. I think it was absolutely worth reading or listening to, or the next, call it 45 minutes or so, gives you most of what you need, maybe everything you need, when it comes to the super important lessons in this book.
I think it's going to hopefully make our listeners' lives a little bit easier and a little bit smarter. One thing that also stands out to me with this is, besides just calling it BFI, which is the best acronym ever.
BFI.
Behavioral finance, BFI. It sounds so much cooler when you say BFI as opposed to just behavioral finance, right? But I think back on when we first started working together years and years ago, I think that's right when Vanguard put out their study on the value of financial advisors and how... I believe, oh my gosh, it was way back in the day, and I know they still do that study now, but I think they said that for the value of a financial advisor, you might be paying 1%, but you would have a 3% return just because of the fact you've got somebody holding your hand and actually helping guide you. Is that correct?
Well, it's similar to that, and it's, yes. And first of all, not everybody needs a financial advisor, because there are great books like The Psychology of Money that can guide you with really good long-term habits.
And BFI, great BFI habits.
BFI habits. I would call these almost psych-fi habits. They're a little different than behavioral finance habits. They're similar, but this is a little more psychological and I think a little easier to implement. The Vanguard study attempts to figure out where people get the most help around financial advice. And you can get a lot of things like asset allocation, diversification, really just through products. You can go find a fund that does a lot of that for you. And those are all important pieces of the equation. But some of the things a financial advisor will do for you or a firm will do for you are those things that you could technically just do on your own. And a lot of people do manage their assets on their own. And then there's a huge percentage of the country, and there's been various studies on this. I don't know if it's 30 or 40%. I've seen studies it's 50 or 60%. And when your asset levels increase and they get higher and higher, you tend to end up having there's a higher percentage of people that do get financial advice just because the stakes get higher and higher and they're so high. Even if you are a great investor, great with your own money, it really helps to have someone by your side who is maybe a coach, a mentor, and can be alongside you in the journey. I remember before spinning was big, before Peloton ever came out. So maybe 10 years before Peloton is the first time I ever went to a spin class. Ooh,
a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. Probably 20 years ago, my wife and I would go to these spin classes together. Again, that seems like with the number of kids we have now and all the weekend activities, that seems like such a far away event that could ever happen now. But I remember one of the instructors, one of the lines they would say over and over in these classes is, even Flojo had a coach.
Oh, I love that.
Do you remember
that.
Flojo? Flojo was the one of the best female Olympic runners in the United States.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I don't know if I remember her, but you guys have talked about her enough on here. I know Flojo.
Flojo is, again, one of the best female runners in U.S. Olympic history. And at the time, Flojo, I think, was even more popular. So I remember that phrase, even Flojo had a coach. And no matter how good you are at something, there comes a time when it's super important to get some coaching. So what Vanguard essentially says is that there may be some help from an advisor to make sure you do the fundamentals, the basic building blocks of investing, diversification, asset allocation. But the planning side and keeping an investor's eyes on the long-term prize, that in itself can add a huge amount of value over time, because then that in turn can help with the behavioral or psychological side of making sure that you're comfortable with your investments, you have lower levels of anxiety around that, which lead to better financial decisions, and then coaching behaviorally through difficult times in markets or euphoric times in markets to not go way outside the parameters of what your plan calls for so that you end up in a really bad situation. So where Vanguard is saying that the value of advisors, it's a long list, but a lot of it has to do with the coaching aspects and the guidance that can be very psychologically helpful and lead to better outcomes. And that's what Vanguard says in their, what I believe is called their Advisors Alpha study. All right, so we're going to start out with I think that we set this up. And again, we're going to go through 14 of these. I'm going to give you a quick preview. Number one is no one is crazy, which is kind of the best name of all of them. Number two, freedom, as in Braveheart. Three, luck and risk. Number four, knowing you're enough. Number five, the power of compounding. That's just the first five. We're going to get to 14. Here's this initial story, though, that he starts out with. And this is really about how when it comes to investing, there's great parity no matter how smart you are, no matter how educated you are. This is one of the places around the world, and it's obviously an important place. It's a cornerstone of our financial foundation. When it comes to investing, there's great parity regardless of your education level. And I think that's even more true today than ever with resources like books and how much we can learn online. 50 years ago, it was only the rich that had a stockbroker. Today, financial information is rampant. Now, that can be a bad thing as well, but there's certainly lots of good information out there. Morgan Housel was a valet, and in his, let's call it his teens and 20s, and he was a valet, I want to say, in we'll call it LA or San Francisco, some rich technology place, and would see technology millionaires come in all the time in their fancy cars. And one of the stories he told was there was a guy who was so boastful and into his money, he'd carry around $10,000 in cash. He's tipping everybody $100 bills. He broke a lamp in a hotel room, and God forbid the manager said, you're gonna have to pay for it. It's $500. He said, $500? Here's $5,000 for the lamp I broke, and never bother me again. He also got a large bag or suitcase of gold coins. I don't know how much this cost, call it $100,000, maybe more. Him and his buddies went out to the coast on the beach and started skipping the gold coins. The point of that story was that even though this guy was super wealthy, he was so ridiculous and irresponsible with his spending that Morgan kept wondering, well, at some point, I guess maybe rich people, because they have so much, they can just literally do whatever they want with their money. About 3 or 4 years later, the guy was bankrupt. The point here is that the equation of wealth over time is really twofold. It's obviously the in, but it's also controlling the out. And that's a theme that he talks about throughout the book. As an example, there's a story of Ronald Reed, who was a gas station attendant. He fixed cars. He was a janitor at JCPenney. No one ever thought he had any money to speak of. Lived in a little cabin in the woods, chopped his own firewood. In 2014, he passed away at the age of 92, and Ronald Reed finally made the headlines. And he did so for his extraordinary wealth that he accumulated, that no one thought that he had anything. In any given year, on average, about 2.8 million people pass away in the United States. And that was the number in 2014. Fewer than 4,000 people left this earth having amassed more than $8 million. Ronald Reed did. Where did he get all the money? No inheritance, no lottery, just working and saving as a janitor and a car mechanic at a gas station. And socked away money in high quality blue chip stocks and amassed over $8 million by the time he left this earth. Then he contrasts that with a guy named Richard Foscone, who was a big-time executive CEO at one of the big investment companies in the U.S., the cover of magazines, made millions of dollars a year. But he also had multiple houses. He had an 18,000-square-foot home in Greenwich. And after the 2008 financial crisis, ended up bankrupt.
Yeah, 18,000 square feet's a lot to keep up with if you don't have a lot coming in.
The big difference here is that Ronald Reed, he was both patient and controlled his outflow at the same time. One was Harvard educated. We don't even know if Ronald Reed finished high school. So there's great parity in amassing wealth. You do not need to go to Harvard. You do not need to be the CEO of a massive company. Anyone can end up with extraordinary wealth. And Mallory, financial success, it's not necessarily a hard science. It's more of a soft skill. And that's what we're teaching here today.
I love it. So are we going to learn the soft skill, the 14 soft skills it takes?
I don't know if they're all soft skills. Let's go through these. So first of all, is this, no one's crazy.
That's hard to believe.
Well, or you could probably say everyone's crazy. Everyone's a little crazy.
That sounds way more realistic in my experience.
No one's crazy, meaning that financial behaviors are really, they're deeply influenced by our own personal history and our own personal experience with money. It's not just about logic or education. It is about how we grow up and how we see, what lens we see money through. And think about how different that is for everyone. You're wealthy, you can grow middle class, you can grow poor. You can grow up poor and have a frugal family or a family that spends every dollar they have as soon as they have it. You can grow up in a wealthy family and with super frugal parents. You can grow up in dark times like the Depression and have a great fear of spending money to begin with. You can be born, you can be 18 and enter the working world in the late 1960s, and then you're faced with dramatic inflation over the next decade or so and feel like inflation is always the scariest thing you have to deal with. You could be born and you could be 18 and go into the year 2000 and live for almost two decades with very little inflation, very low interest rates. And that's what then sets your parameters for the rest of your life. And you just, we just can't change that. So we all have our own unique money recipe. So someone's aggressive with their investing or conservative with their investing. It's not that any one person is right or wrong. No one's crazy because we're all operating under our own set of money DNA. You ever bought a lottery ticket?
Oh, rest assured. Actually, I went through a little bit of a phase a couple of years ago where, like, when I went to the grocery store, I would like to grab just one scratch off. And it wasn't all the time by any means, but it was kind of fun because it's like, you know, you play like those $1 scratch offs enough. For the most part, you kind of just keep getting another ticket is really what would happen, right? You get it, you scratch it, get one more ticket. You go back, you change it out, you get another one, and you get another one, right?
Or like, okay, so you went through a lotto ticket phase.
Yes, yes.
And really it was more for fun.
Yes, correct. And then of course, actually, Reeves and I always like to say that when the lottery hits $1 billion or more, we like to invest. We invest in our financial future.
All right, well, think about this. So lottery spending in the U.S. is more than sports events, movies, books combined. Who buys lottery tickets?
Everyone?
Mostly poor people.
Oh, well.
Okay.
Yes.
On average, they spend $412 a year. But as crazy as it may sound, maybe they're not that crazy. To the person that makes $30,000 a year, they may look at the world and say, look, you're living this wonderful life if you're middle class in America or you're the upper class, which, by the way, you can't not see it today in America. So it looks like everyone out there is living this dream life relative to you if you're struggling financially. So for this group that primarily is who spends money on lottery tickets, it's not that crazy to them. So if you start putting yourself in someone else's shoes, whether it's someone you think is crazy and buys an 18,000 square foot house or someone that shouldn't be spending any money on a lottery ticket, if you really put yourself in their shoes, they have a financial justification for it because that's what their money DNA taught them. And I think what's important about this is just accepting that no one is crazy. That means you are not crazy on how you think about money. And financial decisions are made between a husband and a wife and a father and a son and a mother and a daughter. And there's great rationale behind that. So if we understand that the world isn't crazy when it comes to money, understand that you're not crazy either and just accept that's how you are. And that's the first step to understanding how to be good with money. The other thought is that money, talking about money is actually a relatively new game. 401ks didn't even start until 1979. Roth IRAs, not even until the 90s. There weren't even, car loans didn't even take off until after World War II. So to some extent, money education, this is, even though money's been around for tens of thousands of years, education around money is infinitesimally small relative to the course of history. We're just learning. How does setting the goal to have income for a lifetime sound? It's not a trick question. Many happy retirees create income for a lifetime, and it's something that's called income investing. It's a way to harness the power of many different forms of cash flow, including rent, royalties, dividends, distributions, and interest. If you'd like help with income investing, you can reach Capital Investment Advisors at yourwealth.com. That's yourwealth.com. Number two, freedom. Here's what this money lesson's about. The true value of money comes from the freedom and the autonomy that it gives you in your life and over time. Not the material side of money. It's really about your economic freedom.
I feel like most of our happy retirees probably relate to that really well, because that's really what retirement is focused on. You save enough to the point that you can leave the workforce comfortably.
Freedom of autonomy, freedom to do what you want, when you want, as Morgan Housel will say, with who you want, whenever you want. And that control over one's life, according to one of my favorite researchers from the University of Michigan, Agnes Campbell, was a psychologist who wanted to know what really made people happy. This is back in the, this is way before we started doing happiness research, money and happiness research. But back in the 80s, he wrote a book called The Sense of Well-Being in America. And the common denominator around happiness wasn't about income, wasn't about career success, wasn't about popularity, wasn't even about friends, socialization. It wasn't all the things, it wasn't a lot of the things we talk about. Socialization, I put on a really high part of that list. And I know there's a Harvard study that shows that your relationships are the most important. But what Agnes Campbell says is the most powerful common denominator in happiness is having a strong sense of controlling one's own life. That's a more dependable predictor than anything else on positive feelings. So money is about freedom and autonomy. And having that control over your own life throughout retirement particularly, that is one of the strongest predictors of happiness. We talk about income and dividends and investing here on the show, but perhaps the ability to make those choices and the freedom to have those choices throughout our lives, that is perhaps the most significant dividend that money can pay. And I think it may even be more important today, Mallory, because of this. Our society in America, and we're in the best system that there is, capitalism. And we're in the best system of capitalism in the world, the United States. But it is a pressure cooker. And we used to, let's go back a half a century, not that long ago, we used to be able to go to our jobs and then leave that job and go home. And there wasn't anything to do. There was no email and there was no Zoom call. There weren't 9 p.m. meetings with your team, particularly if you made something. Imagine if you were in manufacturing, you would actually be somewhere, put something together, make something, and you go home and you don't think about it until you go back the next day. And over the last half century, we've become a service economy. And a service economy is much more around the clock. Most of you listening are in a service industry. Think about how work is now for most of us. It is to some extent a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week endeavor. If you're not working and getting emails and responding to emails and having team meetings and Zoom meetings, you may be thinking about work because you might have to do something like that. And it may be after dinner. It may be 9 o'clock at night. It may be on a Saturday. Maybe on a Sunday. And Housel brings up something we've brought up here on the show many times, is that we always look at the Gallup polls around workplace happiness. And we know that in America, a very small percentage of people are really excited and happy about their job. And the majority of Americans are either quiet quitting or loud quitting. And that is because there is, I think, one of the primary factors of why we have such high levels of job dissatisfaction is that we don't have control over our time like we used to 50 years ago. Think about what's happened. 1950s, we're a much richer country than we were in the 1950s. We have 10x today at our fingertips than we did in the 50s. We're much wealthier, but we're not any happier. And how do you explain it? I think it's gotta be a lack of general sense of freedom from work as our society and our economies change. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. This is still the best system that we have in the world, and we're lucky to be born here. But work in America, we know, takes its toll, and accumulating wealth can bring us the freedom that we all desire. Speaking of luck, number 3 on my list, luck and risk. How lucky do you think Warren Buffett is?
I definitely say he's he's so smart. I don't know if you could really say it's just luck.
How could you dare say it's about luck, right? Yeah. He's smart. What about Bill Gates? Smart or lucky?
He worked so hard. Like, it's definitely, I don't know if I would attribute luck there.
There's no luck, right? He's got to be, he's the smartest guy and he's worked his whole life and he's built the best product that's in every computer around the world that gets annual subscriptions. It's an amazing, right? It's an amazing thing that he's built. But the reality is that success often involves a very real element of luck, and acknowledging that can lead to more humility and better decision making. And all of these are trying to, and really all of these lessons, I think, help us make better decisions. Okay, so you don't think Bill Gates is lucky?
No.
Okay, I get it. I would say the same thing. However, perhaps nothing is quite as good or as bad as it ever seems. Bill Gates just so happened to go to one of the schools, one of the few schools in the country that had a computer.
Oh, well, yeah, because what year was that?
Well, here's the story. In 1968, there were a little over 300 million high school students around the world. There were about 18 million high schoolers in the U.S., there are about 300,000 high school students where Bill Gates lived in his state, in Washington State. There are about 100,000 in Seattle where he lived. But there were only 300 high school students, 300, that went to a high school with a personal computer. So it was literally one, let's go back to the lotto, out of 1 million. 300 students out of 300 million around the world in that year that had a personal computer. Massive, massive head start for Bill Gates. Now, of course, all the other ingredients are that this guy's brilliant. He loved computers. It was his life passion to start a company around computers. Yes, so there's a massive side of what he put into it to bring his luck to fruition. But what if Bill Gates was born in Montana? What if he was born on a ranch in Montana and herded cattle until he was 25 and never saw a computer until he was 40. He wouldn't have been the founder of Microsoft. That's the reality. So yes, there's a lot that goes into success, but some of it has to do with luck. I would call this more fortune, just good fortune.
For so many reasons.
For so many reasons. Bill Gates had a great friend. His name was Kent Evans. He would have likely been one of the founders of Microsoft along Bill Gates. They were best friends, late nights on the personal computer coding things. Ken, late in high school, died in a hiking accident. So that's the other side of luck, and that's bad luck. So if we look at risk, let's call it the complements luck, Microsoft would have never come to fruition if Bill Gates hadn't taken that risk to begin with.
I've always heard those who are lucky are the ones who are willing to take chances and put themselves out there. You have to take that risk to find the luck.
And to find luck. And that's I think that's a really important way to look at that, is that if you're not in the game, you can't get lucky in the game. And risk is the perfect complement to being able to get lucky. But, of course, as we know, the ultimate example of bad luck because of risk, his best friend, Kent Evans, who wasn't there with him in that journey because of something, there was a risk he took, and unfortunately, luck went the other way. Ideally, in our money journey, we have a little bit of both. We take some risk and we get some luck. And the longer we're in the game, provided we don't get too over our skis like Richard Fascone in the beginning, then we allow the luck to happen. Number four, knowing you're enough. Knowing you're enough.
I feel like I hear this a lot in those, makeup ads and everything. You are enough.
You like are
as
enough.
As an individual, you are
enough. Oh, it's enough. You're enough.
You are
Isn't
enough.
Isn't it more, you're enough. It's yeah. Okay.
It's good. You don't worry.
You're just because you're not successful, it's okay. You're enough. Is that what it does?
I think it's more like, oh, you're not very pretty, but you are enough. Oh, if it's a makeup ad.
Okay. All right. Well, I feel like I'm making people mad today on this podcast. I don't know.
We're just trying to pick a fight.
Knowing you're enough, recognizing when you have enough, is critical to avoid pitfalls that can come from greed. And then also maintaining financial peace. There is something, again, this goes back to capitalism and free markets in America. Part of what makes America great and so productive is that we're always looking for more. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. But when it comes to financial planning, if you're always moving the goalposts, then you may never feel financially fulfilled. So if you want to get to 1 million, but then you move your goal, if your goal is to get to 1 million, and then you get to 1 million, your goalpost, we need to get 2 million, then you're always chasing and maybe less at peace with your overall, let's call it wealth or plan. You get to $2 million now. Oh no, I need to get to $5 million. So we're very good at moving the goalposts out in America. And it's a really powerful thought to know if enough is going to give you financial peace of mind and lead you to the economic freedom you want and happiness in retirement, then it is very powerful to know when enough is enough. Are you like that? Do you feel like you're always pushing out the goalposts?
Constantly. It's one of those things.
Like in your business, because you're a business owner. You thought, oh, I want to get here, and then you get there and you want even more?
Exactly.
Are you guilty of that?
I'm so bad about that. And I think most people are. I think it's easy to say, all right, I got there, I did the thing, and now what? That's always a question, right?
Yeah, that is America. And I think it's not necessarily a bad thing in business, but I think it's a powerful thing to start to acknowledge. And I think it's a very powerful thing in planning. Number five, the power of compounding. We already know the mathematical power of compounding. 10% on $1 million is $100,000. A 10% return on $100,000 is 10 grand, not bad. But if you get to the point where you have $1 million, now 10%, a 10% gain is $100,000. At $10 million, a 10% gain is $1 million just in any given year. So we know that power of compounding, but we don't tend to see it until the numbers start to get big. But compounding is the very thing that allows us to get that critical mass. So when it comes to compounding, any strategy that allows you to stay in the game the longest and sleep well at night is likely the right strategy. Maybe this goes back to luck and skill. We'll talk about Warren Buffett for a second. Boy, the best investor of all time, right? The most well-known investor
goat,
of all time.
Goat, if you will.
He's the goat. But it's hard to find anyone else out there that has been able to stay in the game longer than Buffett. Now, I'm not saying he got lucky here, but his true advantage when you see his long-term compounded rate of return has been time. He's been investing for almost 3/4 of a century, so over 60 years of investing. If he had started a decade later, or maybe hung up his cleats and stopped investing, let's say when he was only 80, then that compounding would look very, very different because the difference in time. There's a guy named James Simons, who's another investor who is arguably a, quote, better investor, because this is a guy who has had much better annual returns to the tune of over 60% annual rate of return. But he still doesn't even come close to matching Buffett's long-term compounding just due to time. He had a much shorter run. He was only in the game for, call it, a meager 15 or 20 years. That's nothing compared to 60 plus. So if we think about compounding, yes, we think, oh, we want the best rate of return. That makes total sense. We want the highest returns. But successful investing isn't necessarily about the highest returns and big home runs, because the home runs usually can't be repeated. It's about getting pretty good returns that you can stick with for as long as humanly possible. That's when compounding runs wild. Number six, getting wealthy versus staying wealthy.
Two different skill sets.
So think about this. So we're trying to navigate this journey of wealth. This lesson says you need a mix of short-term paranoia to ensure your survival and long-term optimism to find growth. It's two very different things, almost like a barbell personality. So it should help you accumulate wealth, but then more importantly, preserve and keep the wealth. There's a famous investor back in the 20s and 30s named Jesse Livermore. And everyone was on margin and investing heavily in the stock market. For one reason or another, Jesse Livermore shorted the market the day before Black Monday. So while everyone was throwing up in their trash can because losing so much money and going bankrupt over the course of a day or a few days, Livermore came home, was like, wow, this is the best day I've ever had in the market. Of course, if we short stocks and they go down, we actually make money. In fact, he made the equivalent back then of $3 billion. So again, one of the richest people in America. At the same time, there was a famous story about one of the richest people in America named Abraham Germansky, who lost almost everything during that week and was reportedly kind of walking the streets and ultimately took his own life. But it was only a few years later that the same thing happened with Jesse Livermore. So he had made all this money shorting the market and then was already wealthy and then continued to bet big and bigger and bigger and bigger. And he went bankrupt and ultimately took his own life. They both got wealthy, but it wasn't enough. This goes back to moving the goalposts. So they didn't stay wealthy. So getting money and keeping money are two different skills. So you can be really good at making money, but it is a different skill when it comes to keeping money. And that's where this mix of long-term optimism and short-term paranoia kind of blends together. One helps you accumulate over time. One helps you keep the money that you have. So this lesson essentially says to us that we've got to be optimistic about the future, but paranoid about what could stop you from getting there. Sensible optimism. So knowing that eventually there will be a good outcome, but the journey is going to be filled with a bunch of landmines and it's going to be filled with some pain. Think about this. Over the long term, over the last, call it 170 plus years, we know just how prosperous this economy has been. Our standard of living is up over 20x over that period of time. So if you're to zoom out, all you need to do is just, hey, let's just invest in America. Long-term optimism. But also know that there's going to be shocks constantly along the way. Short-term paranoia. It's okay. But we don't want to let the short-term paranoia scare us out of that long-term journey. Even though during that period of time, we had 9 major wars. Almost 1.5 million Americans died while fighting in those wars. Over 99% of all companies during that whole period of time that were created also went out of business. 4 presidents were assassinated. We had a pandemic that killed 675,000 people in 1 year. We had 30 separate natural disasters, 33 recessions that cumulatively lasted 48 years. Stocks during that period of time lost over a third of their value 12 different times. Annual inflation was over 7% in over 20 separate years. But again, over that period of time, with all those hiccups and those landmines, our standard of living up 20-fold. Long-term optimism.
Wes, we have covered so much already. I think it makes sense to pause right now. And why don't we pick this back up in 2 weeks and we'll finish our lessons from the psychology of money then. Hey y'all, this is Mallory with the Retire Sooner team. Please be sure to rate and subscribe to this podcast and share it with a friend. If you have any questions, you can find us at wesmoss.com. That's WESMOSS.com. You can also follow us on Instagram and YouTube. You'll find us under the handle Retire Sooner Podcast. And now for our show's disclosure. This information is provided to you as a resource for informational purposes only and is not to be viewed as investment advice or recommendations. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal. There is no guaranteed offer that investment return, yield, or performance will be achieved. Stock prices fluctuate, sometimes rapidly and dramatically, due to factors affecting individual companies, particular industries or sectors, or general market conditions. For stocks paying dividends, dividends are not guaranteed and can increase, decrease, or be eliminated without notice. Fixed income securities involve interest rate, credit, inflation, and reinvestment risks and possible loss of principal. As interest rates rise, the value of fixed income securities falls. Past performance is not indicative of future results when considering any investment vehicle. This information is being presented without consideration of the investment objectives, risk tolerance, or financial circumstances of any specific investor and might not be suitable for all investors. Investment decisions should not be based solely on information contained here. This information is not intended to and should not form a primary basis for any investment decision that you may make. Always consult your own legal, tax, or investment advisor before making any investment, tax, estate, or financial planning considerations or decisions. The information contained here is strictly an opinion, and it is not known whether the strategies will be successful. The views and opinions expressed are for educational purposes only as of the date of production and may change without notice at any time based on numerous factors such as market and other conditions.